direct from the web, it's Billy Masters Live. And now, please welcome your host, Billy Masters.
Oh my God, I'm going to have to start writing the lyrics. Sitting and singing and dancing and oh my God. Hi everyone, welcome to Billy Masters Live. I am, of course, your host, Billy Masters. I'm seeing that there's a little bit of, let's see if we can pan. Nope, wrong way. Jesus God, you know. I sit backstage and I talk about how prepared I am. And here I am. See, at the very top right there, you can see where the blue screen ends. I will fix that at some point. There are some things I have control over, some things I do not have control over. One thing I do not have control over is somebody putting up the date. Today is Thursday, February 18th. If you're in Boston, we are expecting snow. I'm not sure how much snow. I wanted to go out to dinner afterwards, so I hope there's not a lot of snow. Anyway, can I just say, sometimes I think the show isn't even going to happen. And here is the difference between season one, 75 shows, and season two, 3 shows in, is that I'm sitting here saying, if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. I'm not sweating it. I've got, you know, there's a year. I came to Boston. I had surgery on my left shoulder March 12th. So I guess I came here March 10th and I didn't leave. So this pandemic, it's like a year in. And I don't know if I'm just getting used to the new normal or if I just don't care anymore. I don't know. But anyway, we are here. I have to first thank everybody. There were like 10 guests on our tribute to Mary Wilson Tuesday. I have to thank everyone because it was an incredible show. And I was switching between guests and videos and photos. And if you look back, I usually have my big water glass, which I don't have right now. See, no, oh, there's a little water, but not water, and you'll see why in a minute. But at one point, I filled it and hit the glass, and it fell on my keyboard, and so I was worried the whole show was going to short out. Happily, I had my notebook next to me, so I was able to run the show from the notebook, and then I had to run out and swap the keyboards and get a different keyboard. It was a mess, but I'm a showman. The show must go on. So you didn't see it, but if you look back, you'll see it. And we've already had like over 4,000 views on the Mary Wilson show. So thank you. Thank you all for watching. It was a tough show, and I'm glad we did it. Okay, this is not a tough show. This is a fun show. We have, of course, legendary actors. See, look, he can't even see into his screen because he's in the sunlight. I miss being in the sunlight, Eric Roberts. It's all right. We're not going to you yet. You can keep that, you know. Maybe we should get you a visor, like a Billy Masters visor, like you were going to Disney or something. Anyway, Eric Roberts is going to be here with his wife, Eliza Roberts. We've been talking about doing this for months in schedules. Eric Roberts is very busy during a pandemic, so we'll talk about that and his amazing career. And we're going to start with my good friend, New England Cable News, NECN's political contributor, Sue O'Connell will be here. But I want to talk about the passing of Rush Limbaugh, who I didn't really care for. You know, my friend Lynn Samuels, who worked with him at WABC, would always call him a fat fuck. She also said that about Chris Christie and pretty much anybody who was overweight and she didn't like. She would also say she was a fat fuck. So, but I have to say, I'm reading all of these stories about how Rush Limbaugh contributed or really began hate speech and propaganda against gay people, women, minorities, etc. And all these people are chiding him for hate speech. And they are the most vitriolic comments I have ever read in my life. They're saying they wanted to piss on his grave. They're glad he's dead. They wish he had cancer earlier. And I'm thinking, you know, it always troubles me. As somebody who is a commentator, it troubles me when people do something that they're accusing someone else of doing. And I have one friend, my friend Freddie in Las Vegas. Hi, Freddie. He'll tell me if I'm too close or too far or too loud or too soft or if my hair doesn't look good. I hear it all the time. Nobody really cares about my performance. They care about how I look. Anyway, Freddie will sit there and get very worked up about things that he sees on TV, and his blood pressure will go up and he'll just start screaming and yelling and whatever. And I'm very calm, and I'm very sort of, I understand, I'm able to understand two sides at the same time. Then I have another friend in Los Angeles who will accuse me of being a closet Trumper, and because you understand him, that means that you are one. And it's like, you can, I understand Rush Limbaugh, who I don't know if he believed everything he said, just like I don't believe Trump believed everything he said. I think that they are performers and playing to their base and looking out for their own interests. And if hate speech is getting you more viewers, then trust me, Rush Limbaugh did it. I, of course, am filled with love and light. As our first guest will tell you, I have known her since she was falling down drunk in a bar that she was allegedly managing, which I don't know how you can do when you're passed out under a stool. But here she is, respected journalist. See how much times have changed. Sue O'Connell.
Hello, Billy Masters. I was never under a stool. I might have been on the bar or asleep.
Might have been on the bar.
Door, but never, ever below a bar. I have to tell you that, remember that other nightclub, Ground Zero, or Mass Ave that we had? A very famous
Zero.
Yeah, it was up by the pizza place that the other place that Don owned in Cambridge.
I never went there.
Yeah, well, there was a very famous actress that came in who was in one really big movie, and she came to the bar, and I don't want to say her name because she's now turned out to be a respectable.
Can you text me?
Like us, yeah. I'll tell you later. I'll tell you after.
Oh, because I would have given clues.
Said,
okay,
you know,
go ahead.
Closing, you know, it was Cambridge. We're closing at 1:30 or whatever it was. I said, we're closing right now. And she said, don't you know who I am? Honest to God. And then went to lean on the bar stool, yeah, and there was no stool there, and she just completely fell on the ground.
So, you know, it's right up there with your Belinda Carlisle story.
Yeah, well, so I'm showing Ruby, like my daughter, these classic movies, you know, and I tell that story, like, there she is. And yeah, I'm not.
Oh, this person was in a classic movie.
A classic movie. I think it was like the only movie, big movie she made. But I'll
was
tell
she
you.
Was she younger or older than me? Was she our age?
Our age, yeah. Yeah, she's our age. And then Sybil Shepherd came in once when she was it Sybil Shepherd? Yeah, Sybil Shepherd was dating the doctor in Cambridge, or Barry.
Yes, he was. Yes. I remember that.
And I was working at Man Ray, where we were, Man Ray.
I worked as well, yep.
And it was like 8 o'clock at Dresden Dolls, or Dresden Dance.
Dresden Dolls, yeah.
Dresden Dolls was playing, and they were, and the kid at the door came to me and said, there's some woman outside who looks really nice and doesn't have an ID, and told me to get the manager because for sure he'll be let in. That's my story.
I thought of you last week because I was watching the whole Wendy Williams weekend on Lifetime, and while they kind of skim over it, I'm like, oh my God, Sue O'Connell, Wendy Williams, and I all have something in common. We all worked with Sonny Joe White at Kiss 108.
Yep, and I have no recollection of Wendy, not because of her, I'm sure because of me, but I don't remember her at all being at Kiss 108 or being there.
Okay, can I tell you something funny? I was at Northeastern when she was there. I was working at the radio station. I was the token white person at WRBB, Boston Spice. And I would have to say that. I would do overnights because, you know me, I'd leave campus, Man Ray, and go there for the 2 to 5 shift. And because nobody wanted that.
I'm so glad we don't have jobs. We only have one. Oh, no, none of us have one job. No.
We have no jobs. So let's go to Rush Limbaugh. Did he have any impact on your life? And do you have any recollection of the impact he made on radio?
Well, you know, I really tried to ignore him. Frankly, I can't listen to that, and couldn't listen to that. And to your point in the opening, you know, the same people who are saying mean things against him aren't necessarily the same people who are saying we shouldn't say mean things. Like, just because they might be liberal or progressive or just common sensed or raised somewhat correctly, doesn't mean that they're also not saying bad things to the people they work with who are also progressives. We had someone in the Biden administration.
Well, that's true.
He wanted to ruin someone's life, and he's let go. We've got Governor Cuomo allegedly saying he wants to ruin someone. So,
well, you know, he's like part of a mob family. So you forgive him. We're from Boston. We know these things.
He's not. Billy's just
saying. I would have slept with him or the brother. It doesn't matter. Both of them. It's fine.
Any Cuomo.
Doesn't matter. The father. No.
But he did, you know, to your point also about whether or not it's a performance, I would rather have it not be a performance than be a performance, because it's even more disgusting if you're pretending to be a bigot than actually being a bigot. Like, I have some tiny, itsy bitsy little bit of respect for people who actually walk the walk and talk the talk, because at least they're being authentic.
I agree with you, right?
Just for money as a show, that's even more dirty and disgusting to me.
Rusty, I had that feeling about George Bush, the younger George Bush, who had said some, not, I don't know if it was anti-gay things, but you certainly knew where he stood.
Right.
And I said, but that doesn't bother me, because I could have a conversation with him and he's not lying to my face. He's being authentic, versus Trump, who really, as you and I know, because we're old enough.
Lied right to my face, told me we could expect LGBTQ progress, right? So,
well, and we also knew him when he was really a liberal.
Yeah.
And I still believe that I believe that I don't know where he stands, because I don't believe all the things he said. I think he's somebody who's playing to the crowd.
Right.
And God knows I've never done that.
Never. Well, back to Rush, he did really revolutionize arming grudges and arming feeling like you've been put upon, and changed radio in a way that didn't exist before him, for better.
And gave a voice to that crowd.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they could listen, they could tune into him and hear them and be affirmed, and then think, well, I didn't say things as bad as Rush Limbaugh did, and he's a big, important guy. So, you know, I always get, mixed about when someone passes away who obviously, from my perspective, doesn't deserve respect. I usually try not to say anything at all. But, you reap what you sow. And when you're going on radio mocking people who are dying from AIDS and HIV and mocking disabled people and mocking Michael J. Fox, for crying out loud.
Who doesn't like Michael J. Fox?
Right. And what do you expect to happen? I mean, when you die, or do you care? I mean, I know there are people who loved him and they'll miss him. And I just said, thank God that the most toxic people in my life are nowhere near
me.
who make me do this, is nowhere near as toxic as Rush Limbaugh was. So rest in peace. These are days that are very religious. Like, I actually hope that, you know, mostly I'm agnostic, but I'm hoping today that there is an actual reckoning and, you know, an accounting. And when you die, you have to go up and meet Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's in charge of whether or not you get into it.
Well, as well she should be. I have to say, I feel the same way. I very often, if I will do something consciously wrong, I think to myself, I'm going to be judged for that, versus when I do something wrong and then realize, oh, that was wrong.
Yeah.
Those are like, well, what can I do? When I purposefully do something bad, I do feel that it's going to come back to haunt me.
It will.
Thank you.
Actually, I'd like to read of things that you did wrong while I'm...
Please don't. Please. It's only a 90-minute show. So I haven't talked to you since we've had a new president. First, let's talk about storming of the Capitol, because I do not get like upset about anything, as you know, like I just like, yeah, whatever. But I did sit here looking at the television in this little room in a Boston suburb thinking, wow.
Yeah.
I am watching something that people will study almost like September 11th, that it's almost surreal.
I would say it's exactly like September 11th. It's been, I was actually on a safety call, an NBC safety training call, watching the MSNBC coverage of the certification with mute on. And I saw the Secret Service move Pence. And you remember, there's a one camera, there's not the pool is contributing, so right. that
it's,
you know exactly
it's what that still.
But it was horrifying. I mean, it's a horrifying thing. These people, many of whom didn't vote, which is, you know, just the ridiculousness of the action, you know, where you're protesting by rioting and taking a capital siege and threatening to kill elected officials, and you didn't even vote.
Right. You're not invested enough to even get out of it.
That's without irony, right? I'm just going to show up. I mean, and many of them clearly, you know, the idea that Trump only appeals to people who are economically disadvantaged. Well, that went out the window because many of them were out on their pensions or took
flying
private planes. You know, so I think that we need to really take a heart. I'm really worried about the cult-like, and I don't mean this in a political way. I mean, I obviously, you know, like you, I get accused of being a knee-jerk moderate on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. But I'm concerned about this cult-like devotion to Trump and this QAnon ridiculousness that is, I think, is really dangerous. And I think that it's
dangerous in what way?
Dangerous politically and dangerous. There are people, elected officials, as we know, who believe this. We have people in Massachusetts who are running for office that just believe these ridiculous conspiratorial lies. I mean, listen, there are pedophiles. There are actual pedophiles. And if you are concerned about that, which you should be, you can work to help organizations and to work with lawmakers and do all sorts of things to help victims and reduce the opportunity for crime. You don't have to go make up some, you know, Hollywood elites killing babies to get their power from them. I mean, and that educated people believe in that. I mean, we've been looking at cults a lot, you know, lately in the media with the movies. It's not an education issue. It's not an intelligence issue. But I think that if we're going to have 20% of our population who belong to a cult as a political party, we should be very concerned.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that those people that Trump said he's giving voice to are not necessarily as informed as they should be, but they get caught up in the frenzy of it. You know, because I don't know what they believe in either.
Well, part of it too is it's almost as if the fact that we haven't had any sporting events where you could go tailgate transferred into let's siege the Capitol, because they're all wearing the same clothes they wear at Gillette Stadium when they're waiting for a Patriots game. Has the fact that we haven't had football that, you know, that you can go to, or sporting events that you can go to.
And you know, that's killing me.
Yeah. I mean, has it turned that they're making their heads explode, that they have to go, you know, attack the Capitol under these false
They're creeps? Using it as an event and for entertainment.
Right.
It's kind of like, you know, all I kept thinking of is that it's so interesting how they say history is cyclical. And I'm thinking this is like the storming of the Bastille, where some people really cared for it and some people just are followers. Or Roman Forum with kill them. And I'm like, do you care if the lion killed the Christian or not?
No, I mean, the impeachment trial after, I mean, the whole thing, I'm anxious to have everyone held accountable and turn the page. I also love how so many of the offenders at the siege were turned in by their family members, right?
Yeah, you know, ex-wives,
ex-wives, ex-spouses, children, adult children.
Neighbors.
You know, that they're just, it's just beyond the pale. And I get it, you know, and I, again, this is like you, I'll get people. I understand some people didn't understand what was happening. Like, they got caught up in it. You and I have been caught up in many exciting concert events, Billy, and strip shows and all sorts of things. It happens, the mob mentality. But
you have to have put yourself in the position to get caught up in it. And there is something to be said for the fact that these people didn't just rise organically. They flew. They got in planes. They got in cars, trains.
Whatever. No, I'm over them. I'm anxious for those trials will go on for a couple of years. We'll see what happens if there are other ways to. We're going to be talking about former President Trump for a long time still.
I hope not.
Maybe years. No, it will be. I mean, there'll be more indictments. It's just more investigations.
Well, since we're speaking about presidents, we're a month into the Biden presidency. And I have to say, it has been incredibly unremarkable in the best of possible ways.
Yes, it's like...
Remember when we didn't talk about the presidents every day?
Just the regular boredom of doing things. And, you know, so far what he's done basically is turn things, everything he can turn back to the Obama administration he has with executive orders. Right. Mm-hmm. So we haven't even made any progress. We're actually just going back to
where we were 5 years ago.
Last day of President Barack Obama's term. Right. And, you know, dealing with the pandemic, which is the major crisis on many levels. But if you notice, his administration, because they're also experienced, are able to do a lot of things, like have a phone call with Israel and also worry about what's happening in North Korea and work on this, because they have competent people, whether you agree with them policy-wise or not.
They can do more than one thing.
Yes, we have competence back in government. So hopefully we can get some things done and not have to talk about Joe Biden every time.
Yeah, because really, there's not a lot to talk about. He's fine. Okay, move on. Well, and also I have to say that we've got this vaccine that we're still all worried about. I know you're in Boston as well. You haven't had it. I haven't had it. I don't think we're going to be able to get it till
we are April-ish. So young and healthy, Billy. It's finally, it's like a list. We finally made a list. We're too young and healthy and pretty to get the vaccine. Well, so there you go.
Well, I will tell you, and you know this, I have traveled a bit because I've had to go down to my property in Florida to take care of things. And it was very strange the first time. First off, Logan Airport, our Boston airport, nobody's there. I mean, I've never seen it so empty. It's almost, again, like September 11th, where first day you could fly, and it was like a tomb. The planes have all been very well behaved. I've been on primarily JetBlue, which people are responsible. Mm-hmm. I haven't had any problems. But then I go to Florida. It's like the Wild West in Florida. You drive down the street and you will see huge crowds of people and not a mask in sight.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't even wrap my brain around that anymore, except, you know, we have, for those who wanted this herd immunity idea, we basically have it now, right? So we let the virus burn through us at a rate that's going to cost us this month probably 500,000 deaths. Average life expectancy dropped an entire year for every category.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Black men. Yeah, and remember, the virus didn't really pick up steam until April or May. So that number was so low that it dropped the life expectancy for the United States by a year. And so now we're getting to a point where we'll have a certain number of people who have been infected, with the idea that we don't know if they're going to get reinfected by or newly infected by the variant. And then we've got, you know, 6 to 7% of the population vaccinated, at least with one shot. So we still have a long to go, but it's clear that, you know, and it's hard to, last time I think we talked about HIV and AIDS at the beginning of the pandemic. You know, there was a good 5 years where Ronald Reagan didn't do anything and George H. Bush didn't do anything. And then, you know, that 5 years, if you bring it to the end of where we were when we started getting treatments for HIV to help people live, all those people that died in the 5 years before them probably didn't need to die, right? Because had the Reagan administration actually worked on getting things going, those people would have been saved. And we can look at the same number, the same math when it comes to the coronavirus. Had the Trump administration taken it seriously in March last year, we would not have 500,000 dead right now. And when the pandemic is finally under control, we're going to be able to see that. And it's sad to have to... Like you said, we keep doing the same things over and over again and don't seem to be learning from it.
Well, that brings us to our big guest, because Eric Roberts has actually, you know, you don't think of this, but Eric Roberts has been in movies which have talked about the AIDS epidemic. And You know, I remember seeing Eric Roberts. We're going to talk to him in a second. I saw him first on Broadway in Burn This. And I remember back then, like, he was this big up and coming, like, you didn't know what he was going to be. He was going to be the next James Dean, the next Marlon Brando. And the pressure that must have put on him and seeing him, he was like the bad boy, but such energy and ferocity. Ferocity? Yeah, I know. But anyway, I am thrilled that he is A, still here, and B, has really transformed himself into this, you know, this actor that has done now everything. He's done comedy, he's done drama, he's played the young hunk, he's been the father, and he's also part of a dynasty in Hollywood, and I am thrilled to have Eric Roberts. Hey, Eric. Oh, wait, I think you're muted. There you are.
There you go. Hey, Eric.
Thank you so much for kind words. Thank you.
How are you? I've been talking to Eliza through this whole thing. And I know that you guys have been, you've been pretty much staying put, although you've been working quite a bit.
Yes, I'm a mask-wearing madman, and I go to work almost every day. The sets are great. The sets are very responsible. There's only been one set I arrived on, and I turned around and got back in the car because I saw it was not safe. It's only happened one time. So 99% of the time, everybody's great. Everybody's very attentive. Everybody's very aware we have a pandemic and we're acting like it, but we got to make a living. So
can I ask you about, because I've been very impressed by reports when I've talked to people who are working in Hollywood and making movies here in Massachusetts, how good people are at following the rules. What is it that is making Hollywood be better? I mean, because usually we're not, right, good at following the rules. So why is it suddenly, is there union pressure that people are, the union folks are working, or is everyone just all in this together and knows that if we're going to get the movie made, we have to keep each other safe?
I think it's desperation. Oh my God, we got to get this done. Okay, put your mask on. Okay, let's go to work. And everybody is great humor. Everybody is early now. Everybody is ready to go to work now. It's but a whole new attitude that's just wonderful because everybody has to be aware of everybody else. So even though it is an industry that invites that, it doesn't always happen. And it's happening everywhere you go now. And everybody's nicer. Everybody acts like my wife now. My wife is the nicest person I know. Hey, Eliza, come sit with us.
Everybody should be so lucky to have Eliza in their life.
Oh, don't we know it? Yeah, everybody is now acting like my wife. They're saying thank you and you're welcome to everybody else. It's really nice. This is Eliza.
I know Eliza.
You invite me when you want. I mean, Eric kind of.
I'm going. That's okay. Eliza, I'm glad to say hi to you. But yeah, we're going to talk about the stuff you two have done. So we'll bring you back definitely.
Yeah, go. It's
but I love the fact that Eric is. Yeah, that Eric is like, yeah, well, I just want to talk about my wife and God love him.
I know.
Eric, when you said that on one set, it didn't feel too safe. When you voiced your concerns, did anybody change anything or did they say, yeah, go, who cares?
They fixed it. They fixed it. Of course they did.
They did.
But sometimes, especially when you're dealing with the kids, and the kids run the industry now. So kids, I'm an old guy. If I get sick, I might die. Let's do something about this. And they do. And I think this has been a blessing in disguise because it's taught us over again all the stuff we learned, you know, before we were five. There are other people. You have to act like it.
Right.
Eric, you have a lot of things in development, and both of you. And I'm just wondering, what's the projection of when we think things will be doing more movies? Right. I mean, you've got like six or seven projects, I think, that are in the future. Are folks starting to feel optimistic that we'll start seeing more movies and more shows being produced?
Everybody's very optimistic, but it's really up to the banks. When the banks feel it safe, the banks give out money. When the banks give out money, everything goes into production. So it's up to the guys with the wallets. And when they feel safe, we all feel safe.
Sue, I've got to take you off for a second. Stay there, though. We're bringing you back in. Because, Eric, one of your friends just popped in. Because, you know, I have surprises on this show, and you never know who you're going to see. And a good friend of mine, Miss Sherry Shepherd.
Hi, guys.
Hello, Sherry. My wife and Sherry bonded so heavy together on that show. And I got all my gossip from my wife through Sherry about everybody on that show.
Sherry has been patiently going back and forth like a billion. Sue gonna ever stop talking? I have work to do. Sherry, you are like the busiest person around right now. Congrats on the sitcom Call Your Mother. Yes. And the gossip show, the pop culture show.
Auditionation, yes. But I have to say, I love Eric Roberts so much.
We love Call Your Mother. We love Call Your Mother.
Thank you so much. I miss you, Eric. I wanted to tell you that.
You know, Eric, what Sherry and I have talked about trying to get her on the show, and we haven't been able to schedule it. And the minute I said to her, well, I'm going to have Eric on, and she's like, I'm in. I didn't even finish the text.
Because I just love
Eric. We miss you, Sherry. We miss you huge.
Oh, I miss you too. I miss you guys so much. And I had, you know, when we did the show Less Than Perfect, working with Eric Roberts was a dream. And this is
how is Jeffrey doing? Son, how's your son Jeffrey doing?
He's taller than me, and he sounds.
How is your son Jeffrey doing?
Oh yeah, no, Eric may not hear us, but she's saying how tall he is. Sherry, show how tall.
He's tall, and tell Eric he sounds like Barry White.
And he sounds like Barry White. Hi, Mom.
He's got a deep voice.
Sherry, what was it like doing?
I'm not getting proper audio.
That's okay, Eric. You can hear me, though. Everybody can hear me.
Tell Eric this.
Oh, wait. Hold on, Sherry. If I take you out and put you back in, sometimes it'll work. Sherry, what was it like working on Less Than Perfect?
I'm Less Than Perfect. You know, it was. We loved each other. We went 4 seasons. We bonded really well. My dressing room was right next to Eric Roberts, and we talked a lot. This is a fun fact that I want to say about Eric Roberts. When he takes a picture with you, Eric.
Oh, hold on, Sherry. We lost you for a second. Now I can't hear. That's okay, Eric. Don't worry. Okay, try again, Sherry.
Okay, so when Eric Roberts takes a picture with the woman, this is a great thing that he does. He'll say, hold on. And as you snap the picture, Eric will kiss you on the cheek. And every woman goes crazy, including me.
Eric, did you hear that? That whenever you take a picture with the woman, you kiss her on the cheek.
I do now, yes.
Well, okay. Well, you know, Eric, now, I mean, I'm no woman, but next time I see you, I want my kiss. Sherry, I know that you're working, and the best is backstage, I'm watching Sherry eating lunch, because this is the only time during the day you have a break. Sherry, thank you. I love you for doing this.
I love you, Eric. Now, I love look, you, Billy.
Eric, that's okay. She's hanging up now. Sherry, I love you. Oh, okay. Eric, we're back. I just wanted to surprise you with Sherry because Sherry is one of my dear friends. And I know how much
you
love
her. So much fun. We love Sherry so much.
Great surprise.
It's a great surprise. Thank you, buddy.
All right, Eliza, stop prompting him.
Eliza?
No, he said stop prompting.
He said no, stop prompting, Eliza.
Yeah, I mean, Eliza's like, you know, Eliza is like the cue card girl, for God's sakes. Tell me how you two met.
We met on an airplane.
Oh,
the MGM Grand 1989.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's right.
I was flying in from Rome to JFK, where I caught a plane from JFK to LAX. She was flying in from Canada and also flying into LAX, and we sat next to each other. And she asked me who my favorite screenwriter was. I said her father. She said, well, he's my father. I said, oh, I had no idea. Asked for a phone number. She said she's in a relationship.
Eliza, who's your father?
His name is David Raphael. And
oh, okay.
You can look him up. And he Yeah, and he wrote a lot. He wrote 3 Days of the Condor, for instance.
Oh, all right, great film.
He wrote a lot of great
all
stuff.
All the Streisand and monster hits, he wrote them.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. The Way We Were.
You've loved some of his movies, I promise you, Billy.
You want to
Well, you know me.
Africa.
Yeah. Yeah.
You too. Now you've been, Sue is back here. You and Eliza and, Eliza and Eric, you've been together now for so many years. What has been the magic of keeping that, that marriage together? Because you're with a very combustible man, or at least he was.
Well, I mean, you know, you always have to kind of look at your patterns and look into your past, and combustible is probably what I was well trained for. So he needs the calming, all right, and I need the person to calm. And so, you know, you can be a great fit for like all kinds of crazy reasons. So so that's one of the things. And then, you know, we really respect each other's art. And we just we're just kind of weirdly as combustible as Eric has seemed to be or whatever. It's very comfy. It's we like the smallest things together. Like this is certainly fun for us. You know, just, you know, talking about watching Lifetime shows, you know, taking a little drive to nowhere. I mean, it's just, and we work together too, which really helps. It's good.
You know, I want to show a clip. You guys did a documentary called Out in the Open.
Yes.
There it is. Yes. There it is. Yeah. I would have put it in Still Store, but, you know, I'm not that prepared. And there are two clips of you two together that I want to show. So let me just show this. Now, make sure Eric knows what clips they are because, you know. All right. This one is good. Okay, listen to this.
I think of myself as being bisexual because I sort of think of everybody as being bisexual. I just think there's kind of a curve and there's no definition. But that's what I think. What about you, Eric?
I don't know. I don't think everybody's bisexual.
What about you?
Me?
How do you identify?
Well, you know me. I identify myself as Eliza's husband, pretty much. I'm Eliza's old man. I don't really have a self-image. I'm like really, you know, I have no sense of self. I'm a true actor. I'm an open book.
Eric, what I love is that, you know, because you've been an actor all your life, you really are open to playing and becoming almost anybody.
Well, it's not the meaning that it infers, but I have a narcissistic disorder. And what that is not vain or egotistical. It's the fact I don't really have a sense of self. I don't have a sense of who I am. I see myself through other people, through other experiences. I am very broken. That's why I married such an intelligent person to help. So
it seems to me that, you know, before you two were together, you were much more acting out and she has been a calming influence on you. That's how it appears.
Well, I think that's a great way to advertise this program. but I don't know that that's true. What I think is true is this: when you have to raise yourself, you don't know where you're going or why. Mm-hmm. And then you meet someone who had to raise everybody around them, even as a child, so they have an understanding of what that is. And when you come together, it just fits. And it fits so perfectly that we maintained it. Who knew? Now, don't get me wrong. I have been the biggest a-hole you've ever met. I've called my wife things you can't imagine. And but my wife is bigger than I am as a person. And she takes hold of me and she makes me feel better for my misgivings. And then I get to work on them. And she even steers me in that department. She's my wife. She's my mother. She's my sister. She's my lover. She's my shrink. She's my acting coach. She has a huge job, and I'm just one client. No. I give my wife incredible due credit for being an extraordinary human being, and thank God she's in my life. That's how I really feel.
Billy, I'm glad you showed that clip. I would expand it even now to to not even bisexual, pansexual. I really think, and I'm, you know, my daughter's gay. She and her wife and their child, their daughter, who's almost two,
Georgia,
live across the street. You know, I'm so relieved. We are so relieved at this movement now in casting and everywhere where it's just like, stop defining and categorizing. I mean, for instance, I wouldn't even buy for Georgia. She wanted nail polish. I do crazy things with my nails sometimes. And so I got the little baby kind, but I wouldn't get the kind that said, for, you know, fun makeup for girls, because it's just for kids. So why do we have to stay still for girls?
Right.
For everyone. So I found the ones that didn't do that, and I got that one.
Yep.
And, you know,
so
even,
she was raised with the permission to become whoever she was going to become.
Yes. And so were my kids, who are many generations older than this baby girl. But yeah, she will be raised that way. She's being raised that way. My kids were raised that way. They had all different kinds of dolls, all different races and genders and this is and that's. And, you know, both of them, my son and my daughter. And that was just an instinct. And, you know, thank goodness that we're moving that direction. What Eric said about having no sense of self, my mom famously said, and she was in our business.
This is the best comment ever said about an actor.
She said, "Darling, you married an actor. You can't expect him to grow up to be a human being."
I have to let Sue go. Sue, thank you for being on the show.
Hey,
I'm going
great.
To follow up.
Well,
you were so good.
Thank you. Great to meet both of you. I hope I see you again on Billy's show.
Yes.
Sue, thank you. I'll talk to you later tonight.
Bye. I'll talk to you
Bye,
soon.
Honey.
Stay well.
Bye. Eric, wait, where are we? Okay. Eric, I have one other clip from this documentary because it's so provocative, the two of you speaking. Let's look at this one. Hold on.
Well, I grew up in the theater, so I was always around your gay men. And as I look back on it now, obviously gay women, but I didn't know it at the time. But, you know, gay men in the theater were always much older than me and very flamboyant. So I found it a lot of fun. And I would discuss it with my father, think I was having a very grown-up, you know, conversation about the gay world. And I was in full acceptance without having to bend over backwards to accept it. It was just how it was. And I never questioned it. I never thought it was a big deal up until I got into the real world and I saw people are really uptight about it. And to the point where when I first realized it, I thought it was funny. I thought, come on, you're kidding, right? But they weren't and they aren't. And that's why it takes this kind of talk to hopefully clear their minds so they can understand that there's nothing to overcome. It is what it is. We have to accept, you know, his hair's brown, you know, my hair's gray, her hair is red. That's how it is. And it's the same with our sexuality. That's how it is. We were born that way. And if you're going to have an issue over something that's natural that you're going to say is wrong because it's not your point of view, you're going to mess somebody up terribly. You're going to confuse them, maybe forever. Why do you want to do that?
You know, I think that's so interesting, Eric, because you were brought up in an acting family. You were surrounded by all different people. You were not born in a vacuum. And is that why you're so at peace with yourself and everyone around you?
I don't have a direct answer because I don't consciously think of it that way. But thank you very much. And I honestly, not to avoid a direct answer, but to,
that's okay.
to tell you my true feeling, I give my wife credit for having me go through adolescence in my 30s and 40s with her. And she re-raised me, because I had to raise myself, and I didn't do a very good job. But then I didn't have any good examples, so I didn't know what I was doing.
And, right.
I look back on all my relationships, and they were all little ink, because I didn't have any examples on how to have relationships of any kind. And so my wife basically taught me everything from the ground up. And that's just a fact, not a compliment. And I like her for it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't really know you. They know the headlines, they know the work, but in prepping for this show, I knew you had sisters, but I didn't realize you really grew up with your dad. You didn't grow up with a big family. You really were split.
I was with them every day up till they were 3 and 5. And yeah, then
well, that's
I
young.
Saw them on rare occasions for the next 10 years.
Mm.
And then I lived with both of them for a couple of years, got them their own place in New York, and they lit out and set the world on fire. And they
certainly did.
Yeah. So that's the long and short of it. I admire and I love both of my sisters very much. Mm-hmm. We had a third sister. She was a half sister. I only met her a couple of times.
And, oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, she committed suicide how many years ago now? About 5-7 years ago. And that was an odd thing in our family.
Yeah, I think that, you know, again, it sounds like such a great family in the sense that you're around all these amazing people, but nothing is all good or all bad, obviously.
Oh, of course not. Sure.
You know, I want to talk about Burn This, which is where I first saw you. And again, I went in thinking, oh, I'm not going to see Eric. I'm going to see this. I'm getting the second cast. And you blew me away because you were so masterful. You were so confident. You really took that theater in the palm of your hands. And that must have been a really heady time for you.
That was one of the three hardest acting assignments I've ever taken on. And it was also one of the three or four most loved assignments I've ever accomplished. And I got a standing ovation every evening performance of that play that I did. And every evening performance I sobbed and they would stand up because I couldn't believe it was happening for me. And I still look back on it and I could cry right now thinking about how that made me feel.
Oh, and, I bet.
Yeah, it was the most incredible thank you an audience can ever give a cast member. And it's so emotional and so visceral and so physical. And so that's that memory of that play for me, is the exhausted state I would be in when I walk out for my curtain call. And then the vulnerable state I would turn into when they would stand up. So that is that performance for me. But then of course there's Star 80 that made me miserable.
Unbelievable. Yeah, and that was my next question. Is it, you seem so dark and tortured, and I'm thinking there's no light in this character. So do you have to live in that darkness through the whole shoot?
Well, not to make it too artificially artistic, but if you don't play an emotion for what it really is, be it something missing or something misplaced or something, if you don't play it for what it honestly is, if you imitate it, people know. And once they know, you will never be a favorite because you tried to steal. You tried to steal. You tried to fool them, and audiences don't forgive that. I know I don't as an audience,
Yeah.
I even hold grudges with that. No, no. He tried to fool me in that movie. He was blah, 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 blah. I'm like an old nasty man about it. And anyway, when I give you, especially if it's a documentary, especially if it's a docudrama, if I'm playing a real person, which I've played probably 8 or 10 times now, I've played real people that have lived. One of my favorite performances is a thing called Saved by the Light, where I played a guy struck by lightning. That was really hard because he was such an unlikable guy. But he became this saint. But if you play a saint who starts out unlikable, you look like you're acting. You have to find a way to it that's legitimate, so the audience goes with you, so they don't see an actor, and so you fall in love with the performances, you know, because of your dedication to them. And
you have played a lot of unlikable people, and I think that as an actor, that has to be challenging for that reason, that you have to engage the audience but be true to the unlikable character.
Internet boost.
I didn't hear any of that. Try again.
The playing an unlikable character is hard because you have to be authentic as an unlikable character, but the audience can't be alienated.
Can you understand me?
Yep.
You hear what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, here's what I think you said that I can help you with. When you're playing people that aren't likable, that's objectively not likable. But when you're playing them, you can't be objective. You have to be subjective. It's your job to be subjective. It is your job not to be objective. You cannot be objective. Once you're objective, you're a reader. You're not a doer. They're very different. And you can say totally objective as a reader and as an understander, but as a doer, you have to give up the objectivity after you've done the homework, and you have to make yourself subjective in that you have to be in the moment. And sometimes it's a horrible place to be. But if you have a leader and you have a guider and you have a guidance system like Bob Fosse was, you can put yourself in his lap and say, tell me what to do and how to do it and when. And he would. And he would say, I want this, this, and this on this, this, and that now. Okay. And you go execute. And sometimes he'd say, stop. No, 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 absolutely not. And you start over.
and you make the adjustment.
Yeah. But you had all the tools to make the adjustment because you had done your homework. Because if you didn't do your homework with Bob Fosse, he was going to cut your hands off.
What did you think of the Fosse, if you saw the Fosse Vernon miniseries and the portrayal of Fosse?
I loved it. But then I love anything Fosse. I do. I mean, I was a groupie before I knew him. I was a groupie as I worked with him. I was a groupie afterwards. He and I were making another movie together, supposedly. He was working on it about the Kennedy relative who got shot in the face up in Harlem scoring heroin. He was doing research on that when he died.
Wow.
I waited about a year and a half, and I called Gwen about that project. I said, Gwen, he was working on blah, blah, blah. Can you find it for me? And she said, quote, oh, let's just let it lay. I'm like, Gwen, no. And then Gwen dies on me. And what's the question?
No, that was, you answered the question. Okay. Let's talk about King of the Gypsies. Another, again, incredible performance.
That was my first time out of the box.
Really?
My then manager, Bill Tresh. I have to give you a description of Mr. Tresh. He discovers Sissy Spacek in the village under the pseudonym of Rainbow, playing the guitar, asked her if she wanted to be an actor. About 3 months later, got her Badlands. He discovered Christopher Walken, who had already been a Tony nominee, I believe, when he got with Bill, but he revitalized his career, got him Deer Hunter, which he got an Oscar for. All kinds of people: Tom Berenger, Tom Hulce, Melanie Maron, Regina Baff, all kinds of great, great actors. Catherine Walker, and he hands me a script one day, and he goes, "This is a script that I think you can take." He goes, "Frank Pearson wrote it. He's going to direct it, and he wants an unknown for it. The studio wants John Travolta, and they've told Frank if he can't find an unknown they're happy with, that he has to cast John." And he said, "Okay."
I didn't know that.
And then he found me. He read me three times. He then screen tested me, took me to the studio and screen tested, said, "This is who I want." And they said, "Okay." And then I started a film career. Who knew?
How did you even get to him?
How did what?
How did you get to him? How did he even find you?
What's he saying? Help me.
Yeah.
How did you even come to his attention?
Internet, so we can hear you better.
That's okay.
There we go.
How did you come to Bill's attention?
Okay.
Right. Thank you.
I was doing a play at the American Academy of Dramatic Art.
Oh, that's why I went to school there.
It's only as good as its current administration.
Yes.
At the time I was there, it was fine. Anyway, but I wasn't happy there. I could see all the teachers were out of work actors, all moonlighting as acting teachers. Mm-hmm. They all had like different techniques. Their techniques were half-assed, uncommitted, not really, blah, 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 kind of stiff. I didn't love it there. And mm-hmm. I got seen in a play there by Marion Daugherty. Now, Marion Daugherty discovered everybody who's anybody in motion pictures from the generation before me. All the Paul Newmans, okay, are up for it. All those guys all have Marion Daugherty to thank. She cast every movie that's anything from Hawaii with Julie Andrews to Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. She cast, wow, everything there was. She was the queen. She sees me in a play at the American Academy. She invites me to her office. She introduces me to her then underling, who became the queen, Juliet Taylor, who cast all the Woody Allen films, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Okay, but she came out of Marion's office. Okay, yeah. She introduced me to a Juliet Taylor, who she said, "This woman is going to eventually rule the world like I do, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I want you to meet Eric Roberts, blah, blah, blah." And Juliet Taylor introduced me to Bill Tresh. Bill Tresh ran my career for the next 10 years and did it very successfully. He was a good manager, and he discovered great people and was a cool cat.
Cool. Well, speaking of iconic roles, Runaway Train.
Got a great story for you.
All right, I'm ready for it, Eric.
About that. Got a story, okay, for you about that. When I got that script, it was an offer, mm-hmm, and it was written as kind of a tough thug who was in jail for statutory rape. Okay. You can't be likable or be forgivable if you're in jail for statutory rape, if you're just nasty. So you have to find some kind of innocence about you to make it not okay, but at least forgivable.
Right.
And it's all in your tone of voice. If I talk like this is Buck, he was supposedly from New York, so he'd talk like this, kind of a thing, kind of a tough cat, you know, blah, blah, blah. I said, "Nah, it's bad for the image of statutory rape. It's going to make him look really gross and nasty." But right, if he talks like this, if he's got a high voice, so he made a booby. Well, I didn't know. I didn't know. She looked older to me. And she told me she was 18. And I didn't know she was 12. I mean, 13. I mean, 14. I didn't know. You know, that's how you have to do it. So I take a script home and I find that. And I like that. And I think, okay, I can do that if they will allow me to change the part. But will they allow that? You know, because
right,
you never know. You know, they might say, no, there's a real reason for that. It's historical or it's whatever it is. And we can't change it. Or no, you know, the writer is, you know, likes this stuff, Eric. You have to respect the writer. Whatever it is, I expected I was going to have to fight. But I get back and I said, Andrei Konchalovsky, who's Russian, he was my director, can I change the accent from talking like this to talking like this, and also change his whole temper talk, you know, way he talks, you know, so it's up higher, so it's not aggressive, so it's not, you know, nasty, so it's kind of dumb and sweet, you know? And he's, Eric, I don't care what you do. You're brilliant. You just do it. So I did. I made him into a country bumpkin who made a baby and went to jail and just fell in love with Buck. I just, he's one of the losers that I've played that I love almost the most.
Do you always do this with your roles? Do you try to find your way in?
You have to. It's like dating. you have to find your way into the comfort zone, and when you find your way in there, that is your way.
Yeah,
it's going to be consistent. If it's fake, it's going to not be consistent. It's like any relationship. You have to be true to it.
Has there ever been a director that wanted you to portray a role completely the opposite the way you thought it could work?
I don't know if I should bring this up because it's negative.
Bring it up, Eric.
And I don't want to sound negative. I don't want to sound like an actor. And it sounds like both. So I'm very careful to bring. But there was an actor once.
A director?
A director once who...
Thank you.
Who... told me that I lost way too much weight for this part, that I looked, you know, not like a tough guy. He wanted a tough guy. And I said, mm-hmm. If I play a tough guy in this, it's going to be cliche. I need to play the mama's boy that this guy is, thinking he's a tough guy. He can't be a tough guy. And he disagreed. And he asked me to resign.
Really?
Yeah. And I said, well, let me think about it. I wasn't going anywhere. I had been prepping this part for 8 months. I got off this part in January, and it was September now that I was having this conversation. So I had lost 30 pounds. I permed my hair, did everything for the part, learned my script back to front, was ready to go. And suddenly he was saying that I was doing it wrong. So I told him I disagreed. He asked me to resign. I said I wasn't resigning. So he went about his way, and they brought in another director. And that director kind of left me alone and was a great director, directed great movies, and was great for us. And that was in the pub Greenwich Village, of course, what I'm talking about.
When of course.
We're getting skinny with perm hair. It's obvious what it is, right? but yeah, so it's only happened really once. Like that. And it did happen where he told me, whatever you're doing, I don't want it. And when I said, well, that's what you're getting, he said, well, then you got to quit. I said, I'm not quitting. So then he went away.
I think that shows, though, a lot of strength in on your side, that you have to be confident and committed.
You can make it noble. You can call it strength. You can call it artistic integrity. You can also call it stupid. You can also call it reckless. You can also call it cocky. You can call it a lot of things. As it were, it worked out. But it only worked out because we have movies on tape. Because that movie did not smash the box office. That movie smashed the video stores for decades. But it did not smash the box office. So without tapes, that movie would not be a classic, and it is a classic.
You know, we talked about that you had an image of being sort of this cocky, hot-headed kind of guy. And it seems to me that maybe isn't accurate. Do you feel that you were that person back then?
And I kind of show up in like character when I go to work. It's just easier to show up ready to go. I don't make life difficult on anybody else. You know, I don't, you know, trespass on them with my portrayal. But yeah, I like living these guys because if you live these guys, you love to hate them. And when you imitate them, they're just kind of amusing or slightly irritating. But when you really play them, they light people up. They make people mad. They make people happy. They make people proud. They make people ashamed. They're wonderfully irritating people I play.
Has there been a character you have not liked?
Yeah. There's one that I don't like. I've played 5 times in a show called Stalked by My Doctor for Lifetime. It was supposed to be 1 or maybe 2 movies, but they're huge hits. So now we just did number 5. And I get recognized all over the world in every airport I'm in, no matter what country, from, oh, the doctor, all these little ladies want to talk to me about the doctor. And I don't like him there is absolutely nothing that he does or is that I take as Eric pride in. Whatever, it's all kind of second rate, but he's clever. So I like play the cleverness, and I take pride in that, because you have to find a way into a character that is affectionate. Because if you don't, you're just going to play it with a cliche. You're not going to play it properly.
But you love playing him, even though you don't like him. I mean, don't you love playing him? Yeah, but he's doing those movies.
He's the only character that I haven't liked that I do love playing.
Yeah, I mean, he's pretty despicable.
Oh, he's funny.
Yeah.
Well, someday, would that be the thing to like, is the challenge of liking him or the challenge of playing him?
I will take that on. Sure, why not?
Yeah, because it seems to me that the harder something is, the more fun in a way it could be.
You have a point. You have a point. The hardest part I ever played, I had the most artistic fun, and that was Star 80 for Bob Fosse. That was the hardest role I've ever taken on.
Well, and again, you've got Fosse there as well.
I know, the ultimate.
There was one role that so many people have emailed me about, and that was, hold on, let's see, where's the picture? You with Gregory Harrison in It's My Party.
Love that one.
And yeah. Was it the first time you had played a gay role?
Had you played an
overtly gay role?
No, I'm thinking. The guy in Mass Appeal gay, I guess.
The guy in Mass Appeal was gay, yeah. No, I had played in gay leads in projects before. Mm-hmm. One of them was an off-Broadway hit that went to Broadway. But this is my first time on film, and the guy who wrote it and directed it was gay, is gay.
His
great mind, great talent, great guy. And he was very careful in how he cast that part. And who is the producer, honey? Who is the producer?
Joel Thurm,
who worked at, mm-hmm. I believe, CBS. Was he from CBS, honey?
No, NBC.
NBC.
She's our fact checker.
He was the producer. And they cast that movie. And they did side by side. They cast every part very specifically and very carefully. And it came down to me and who's the actor it came down to, Eliza? Me and who?
I don't remember.
Now, you know, the one that had all the drug problems at the time.
Mickey Rourke.
Who is the?
There's so many. Mickey Rourke?
You know, the one who got in trouble for heroin when he slept in somebody's house, woke up in somebody's bedroom with a little girl, with a child. He put a child in bed. They decided they wanted him to play it, me to play it, and they couldn't decide. And so they had me read, and I read and read. I think the last audition was in a restaurant, and I was actually reading for them in a restaurant, and they gave me the part, the only really interesting aspect of that journey is this. You know, Gregory Harrison and I are both heterosexual.
Yes.
And most of the cast, and I think all the crew, were gay.
Mm-hmm.
So here's me and Gregory. We don't have a love scene, but we have an intimate scene, and we kiss.
Yeah.
And here these two straight guys who are both kind of square, and they don't practice as kids. They're just going to do it. And so they have the scene, they have rehearsals, blah, 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 but they don't practice the kiss. They do blah. And then action, and we're on camera. And here we're doing the scene, doing the dialogue, and it's a long dialogue scene. And suddenly we stop and we kiss. And it was a real kiss. Now, I know this is any kind of thing about it. When two heterosexual men kiss,
mm-hmm.
who don't have any gay practice, they both volley for outside position with their mouths.
Oh,
because you're used to always dominating, you know your kisses, but you know, suddenly you're kissing another man who also dominates his kisses, and you kind of volley for who's going to dominate the kiss. Okay, when you finally get settled there, your mm-hmm. tongues touch by habit. Oops, but they spring right back out of, excuse me. And it's like really funny how we got through it, and the crew applauded. Now, I have never been more proud of having a crew approve of me than ever in my life. And Gregory Harris and I, we did the kiss, I think only one time, right, Eliza?
I think it was more than once.
You think it was more than once?
Yeah.
Well, she would know because she hasn't smoked
And I pot. Certainly would like to assume it was.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Anyway, Gregory Harrison and I really, really bonded over that kiss.
And
that guy is one of the best actors I've ever worked with, in that he was playing a role that was really kind of a thankless part. He was playing the writer-director of the movie, Randall Kleiser. He was playing right. Randall. And I was playing Randall's yep. lover who died of AIDS. And he was incredible. Watch his performance. It's the best thing in the movie. And I'm my biggest fan. Don't get me wrong.
Lemon water?
He's spectacular.
Yeah.
I think that you both were.
That movie.
I think that I
tell him.
Yeah, I agree with you. No, I got you in there.
Party. Yeah.
See which movie?
So good. It's My Party.
It's My Party.
Oh, It's My Party, yes. Oh, yes. And, you know, it's again, what I would go into it as a gay man with trepidation. Oh, these two straight guys. It was so believable and so beautiful.
Yeah.
That I think it's a great film.
I love hearing that. Thank you so much, Billy.
Oh, yeah. You're welcome. Now go ahead, Eric.
No, because I almost didn't get that part.
Wow.
And I wanted that part. And
why? Why did you want that part, Eric?
What?
Why did you want that part? No, why did you want it? The heroin addict. But why did you want it?
It was a beautiful story about a subject that had to be dealt with right then. It was a day late then. Had to be dealt with.
Yeah, well, that's
and
true.
Had not been dealt with. Kind of with Philadelphia, but not really. Not with the choice of life and death and why,
and love in the relationship too.
So it was.
He's frozen.
No, he's not. He's fine, Eliza.
You're
I've got
frozen.
It.
You're frozen.
Am I frozen?
Okay, now you're unfroze. What again?
Good. No, I agree with you. I think that it's a beautiful film. Okay, let's talk about Less Than Perfect. How did you end up with that?
Andy Dick is one of my dearest friends. Less Than Perfect was just by auditioning and auditioning and auditioning. And when you go in front of a network, they make you prove yourself about 150 times. And mm-hmm. then they call in all the executives and you have to prove yourself another 150 times. And then they say, want to be in a show? It probably won't run. Come with us. And so you go. And every week you're going to get canceled. And every week you're not. So it's like every week. And it's a whole other world. It's a whole other world for an actor. It's a whole other world for a person. It's a whole other world. Sit down, TV.
Okay, just so you know, Eric, someone just texted me. The other actor up for It's My Party, Robert Downey Jr.
Oh yeah, that's right. That's who it was. It was between me and Robert, and Robert Downey is a truly great actor.
Absolutely.
And he was also truly perfect for that part. So quite frankly, I didn't expect to walk away with that part. And I think I walked away with it because of his schedule. So I think I got lucky. So that being said, that's one of my three or four most proudest performances.
All right. Now, going back to Less Than Perfect, are you telling me that people did not automatically assume Eric Roberts could lead a sitcom?
Why would they? I'm not innately funny, and I haven't ever been really funny in a movie except in Pope, and it was a whole kind of, you know, dramatic funny that's very different, and a little bit of Runaway Train, but not very much. But the Coca-Cola Kid was a comedy.
Yeah,
but,
sure.
Oh, but that was after Pope.
Yeah, but it was before It's My Party.
But it was before It's My Party. Yeah. They had no reason to expect that I could hold up my end of the deal. And I kind of agree with them. I was not very good on that show, in my opinion. And don't get me wrong, I'll say it one more time. I am my biggest fan, but I didn't love me in that show. And I didn't love me because of my lack of comedic timing and my lack of enjoyment of the process, because it's a whole other process when you're doing comedy. And I didn't know how to enjoy it yet. I have since learned, but that was after the fact, unfortunately.
Eric,
did it feel? Oh, go ahead.
He kind of replaced himself with Patrick Warburton.
Yeah.
Because he kept on thinking, what they want here is Patrick Warburton, who wasn't available initially, by the way. And then he's talking out loud constantly to the producers, Nina Wass, Ted Wass. He was like, what you really want is Patrick Warburton. And then one day we showed up on set and there was Patrick, who's a really good friend of ours. And they wrote a role for him. And then slowly, I mean, like, we were surrounded by the funniest people in the world. Yeah. Andrea Parker, Zach Levi, his first job. Sherry.
Oh, so funny.
I mean,
yeah.
Andy was better than ever. Sarah
and
Rue. This was an unbelievably
hell of a group.
And the writing and Eric.
The only dip in the comedy.
Oh, and Zachary Levi, we should mention, too.
Yeah. Oh, what a talent.
Dick Van Dyke reincarnated.
Absolutely. Yeah, and what I think about Eric is that you were sort of playing the stuffier straight guy, and you were perfect for that.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, the thing is, you know what, Billy, as a casting director and an actress myself, just having cast loosely sitcoms, that doesn't actually work. You have to be very, very funny to play the not funny sidekick or to play the straight guy like Patrick. You know, if you can do that intense and absurd circumstances, but you still get into the comic rhythm, it did work sometimes because of amazing direction by Ted Wass, who also could have played the role.
Oh, yeah. Well, great actor.
Yeah, great actor and very
director.
Funny. And by the way, obsessed with gruesomely violent drama. Most people in comedy are. Like, he couldn't stop talking about The Sopranos. We were like, we're doing a sitcom here. You know, do you ever watch sitcoms? Like, no, I just watched The Sopranos and some other show that was on at the time that was way more violent than The Sopranos. But it's having the ear. It's having the ear for it. You know, Eric at that point was just starting to learn what to laugh at, much less how to make a laugh happen, right?
Sure.
But you were better in that than you thought you were.
You know? I agree.
Yeah, good.
I think he did a great job, and I think it was perfect casting. I thought of him more like a Ted Baxter from Mary Tyler Moore, which is an awfully hard role to play.
Exactly. And that's what this role in the breakdown, that's kind of what this role was. They wanted a very gorgeous, handsome,
hella
dateable Ted Baxter. And could do the handsome dateable part. He wasn't so sure he could do the
hello. Yeah, well, there you go.
Right. Put a close on that guy.
Shut up. You know, Eric, you're naked a lot. What is this? Look at you, Eric.
I know.
You know, you look pretty good, Eric. You
know, here's what happened. In my first movie, I had a scene without my shirt. And I was really skinny then. I think I weighed 135 pounds or something ridiculous. But I was kind of cut up. So
yeah, you were. So
ever since then, everybody says, hey, you got a great body. Take off your shirt. They don't realize you have to maintain this system. I'm so old, baby.
Yeah, What'd you do? Don't hit my Eliza.
I know.
Yeah, that's going to go viral.
You have to maintain this. You can't just have it. And so they don't realize, in order to have this casually on screen, I have spent an hour every day in my gym.
Do and you still?
I've been closed now for almost a year. So yeah. I spend an hour every morning on my floor. Asked my wife.
Really?
It was like stepping over me going, why do you do that? I love you. And I'm like,
was being that sort of physical look, did that limit your potential as an actor in the beginning?
Oh, I don't know. You'll have to ask my pretty. Bosses.
That's what I'm wondering.
Too pretty. A lot. That was the feedback. How about Eric Roberts? Too good looking. There were a few, but then he was so edgy that he quickly got out of that box. Let me tell you, there's a few people who were in that box and they really had to go crazy proving themselves to get out of it. Cause what happens is you look at the person and you think they can't possibly have suffered any hardship. That's ridiculous jealousy. But so then you can't tune in emotionally and, you know, get on board with their struggle. Cause you're like,
or empathize with
them. I wouldn't be struggling. Right.
Right.
But Eric and he was always offered struggly type of things. But it got in the way a little, not as much as it did for some people, but for
well,
sure.
Also, I only did like three movies before my car accident. And then I had my car accident and I kind of rearranged my nose.
Now you're hideous, Eric. Shut up. You're still good looking, Eric.
But I rearranged my nose and I changed the shape of my face.
Got more character in his face.
Yeah, they said now you look more character.
One of the things I love about you is that you always surprise me. And I think, you know, when you were younger, you were like edgy, creepy, then you're funny, then you're tender. Is there something you haven't shown us?
Great question.
Thank you, Eliza.
I want to play a dichotomy. And what that is I want to play a guy who has to go to work or has to go on an adventure of some kind. He has to be the opposite of what he is. Like, I'm a policeman who has to go undercover as a drag queen. Something completely
Love to see that.
But all in the same, but not necessarily that, but that kind of dichotomy where it's
duality.
Same guy. Yeah, that's what's fun for me that's left for me to have fun with. Yeah.
Has there been a character that has been the most rewarding?
Yeah, there have been a couple. Oddly enough, it was a television movie called Saved by the Light.
Right.
For some reason, that movie, Final Analysis, and It's My Party were, oddly enough, the three most personally rewarding, privately rewarding performances. And I can't tell you why. They just were.
Do any of your characters stay with you when you're done with them? Do you find any hard to shake?
Well,
I should probably ask Eliza, are there any he brings home with him?
Well, here's the thing.
We'll both answer.
Here's the thing. I can say, yeah, sure. When I'm done, I'm done. But we don't know. And what happens is they hang over you like a shadow.
Right.
They don't announce themselves. They don't say, I'm still here, Eric. They don't tell you. They're just there. And you do things like them because you spent every waking minute thinking of them and you and them and you and you becoming them. And now you are them. Bam. And you do what they do and how they do it and why they do it and when they do it. And then suddenly it's over. And you think you dropped it like old clothes. But like any experience, it is in your consciousness. It is in your unconsciousness. It is driving you. It is holding you. It is everything. And it takes time. Like a skint knee, like a sprained ankle. It doesn't hurt the next day or the next week, but it's still injured. You still have to baby it. It's the same thing with recovery from a crazy person who you played. You think you can just drop them. But I know intellectually I can't. It's also why I'm so fortunate I married someone smarter than I am. And I'm not saying this as a compliment. I'm saying it as a fact. It's such a release valve because I can say to my wife, literally, what do I do? And she'll have an answer for me. I would do this, baby. So thank you. And then I do that. And it makes me feel better. Or it makes something even go better. And I have that in her. And I think I have it because I was smart enough to choose her. So I give me credit.
Eliza, which roles has he taken home with him?
You know, it's interesting. The one thing he doesn't shake, well, he's a big reader. Eric is a voracious reader. It seems to be in their family. Emma's a voracious reader. He can't shake his books. Like if he's in a book that's where it's about a really troubling, you know, most of them are biographies or their study of history, a troubling time. He is there and he can get into a real funk, a depression, anxious state or an angry state, just completely absorbed and you can't retrieve him.
I get carried away by
That world. It's very interesting. And I think that's so funny that that happens more with a book than with the character you play. I think that potential's there for him to fall into the precipice. And the way he counters that is he'll be doing a heavy scene. And I think it's a defensive reaction. He's careful not to bother other actors with it. But
I've been yelled at for this, though, because of other actors.
Yeah, they'll say cut, and he'll start playing the mouth bugle and goofing around. And yeah. He'll do that, or he'll put his finger in the clapperboard. So when they're doing the slate, you know, he just becomes a total prankster in the middle of like some hysterical crying scene. And I think that's his way.
To jar himself out.
Yeah. To kind of, and to have it be okay that he fails to do so.
Here's what it is. Here's what it is. When you're playing an emotional state, you're playing a little mini car accident. Okay. To have a car accident properly, you have to control the car accident. You have to be in control of out of control. So when you really get into it, I could cry right now reliving certain things. I could just break. Oh my God, that was so hard to do and I had to go through this to get there. And I could really sob. Even right now, I can almost go there. But so when you get right up to that thing and you've done it, you got to pull back quick. And the only way to pull back quick is to go opposite. To become a walking musical instrument. To become something that is not you, is not the character, is not the place, is not the time. So you're out. So then there is a difference. So you can come back to it. Because you can get messy as an actor, especially if it's emotional, because everybody should feel what you feel. No. Your job is not to feel. Your job is to make them feel. So you must be careful.
You know, I have friends that are opera singers who, when they've learned certain roles, they've cried, like during preparing Madame Butterfly. In the minute they cried, the teacher says, if you can't cry because then the audience won't cry.
Right,
if you're crying, it's all too much. Your job is to make them cry.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's the same thing.
And it's why as an actor, everybody loves this monologue he did in The Pope over my thumb. After I get my thumb, you know, cut off and I go to the hospital and I come back to the room. And I have this 3-page monologue and it has a break in it where I'm going on and on about what happened. I suddenly stop and I say, what the hell happened here? Looking at the apartment. And it's and he says, my girl, she left me. I said, what'd you do to her? And it's a whole other rhythm, a whole other story, a whole other understanding, a whole other part of the character. And that for everybody who loves that movie like I do, know as an actor, that point is the rescue point. What the hell happened to you? That's my rescue point, because I was so into it, I could have drowned as an artist. I could have drowned as a portrayal of that character. But that line pulls me back where the audience is comfortable. And right. I love that. I love Vinnie Patrick for that. And because those are every word in that monologue that I said that day are all written by Vinnie Patrick. And he is, was, will always be a genius.
You know, Eliza, you guys have had a very public relationship. People know Eric and Eliza. It's always the two of you. And there have been ups and downs. And I know that I don't know. Has it been easy to always stay with Eric and to hang in there? Or have you ever said to yourself, I don't need this?
Okay, I missed one part. Has it always been easy to what, Eric? To what?
To hang in there with Eric, or did you ever say, yeah, I don't need this?
Oh,
there
yeah.
were tough times.
Sorry, but yeah. Oh, of course. I mean, the things that run into your, it's almost like Tourette's. It's like marriage Tourette's. I can't do it anymore. I mean, I think, I don't know anybody who hasn't, and I'm sure he goes through it too. I can't do this anymore. What am I doing? How did I get here? But see, the thing is, when you, that's the whole thing with boundaries and all that. What's on the other side? This needs to stop or what? I mean, right? And I mean, I'm not even talking about punitive threats and whatever, you know, or I'll leave. I mean, realistically, what are we really saying? And right. You can find all your own boundaries. I can tolerate only this much. This is my boundary. Because boundaries aren't meant to be a boundary you put on the other person. It's that you've hit your mark. But then, you know, I mean, there was a good, very simple line that wasn't even about this, but it triggers this thought in the movie Unfaithful, which is a brilliant movie, where Richard Gere, somebody says, wow, you could get a lot of money for your house. And he's like, yeah, but, you know, you sell your house, where do you go?
Right, then what?
So, since we all have patterns, if I'm not with Eric, I'm going to be with Eric, basically. It just will have a different place. You're just recasting, but the role doesn't change. And, you know, unless you're going to do a whole shitload of work. Oh, I don't know if we
you're
can say
just
that.
Just recasting, but the role doesn't change.
A whole bunch of work
you
on
can
yourself.
Swear, Eliza, it's fine.
Okay.
Were there things that you wished you hadn't gone public with, like the celebrity rehab or talking about the issues like that? Did you ever want to keep your private life private?
You know, that's a really good question, because I think we have different answers for it.
All right, go ahead.
First of all, celebrity rehab was, I mean, a treasure because of, look at Keaton. I mean, look at using, you know, 20 of his songs and falling in love with them and the world falling in love with them. And, you know, that was completely real. I mean, that,
yeah.
you know.
It was real.
Yeah.
It was almost painfully real at times.
Yes, it was not almost. It was painfully real. But now in terms of because there was a time that Queen Latifah had a talk show for a short while, and she wanted us to come on and talk about some certain things. And I wanted to do it. I didn't push that hard, or we would have done it. I feel like the stuff that we shroud in secrecy just so happens to be all the stuff that we all have in common. And it is exhausting to wear facade after facade after facade. It is just exhausting. And so I feel like something happened the other day. What was it? Oh, yeah. I had a sleeveless dress on, and it's getting kind of stretched out, this one, and I think I might have been in the market with a boob there for a minute. So your choices are, you know, you go outside and commit suicide, you find some way to hope it didn't happen and go frantic there, you go into deep shame and have to see your shrink, or you're just like, it's a boob, we all have them, you know, oh well. And now at this age, I just really think people should, you know, the red table stuff. People should talk about the real stuff. Enough already.
Right.
Enough twisting ourselves into these pretzels of ridiculousness, because it's just a form of a bunch of lying. And I don't think it really helps. So, no, I'm not sorry about anything that we've come out. If it's something where it outs someone else, then don't do that, because that's not your place. But if it's just
And I think Eric is feeling a little different. So, Eric, where do you sit on this?
What's the question?
Where do you fit on this whole spectrum of being open and out there?
Well, it's a technique that I never practiced until I married her.
You're blaming me.
And it's a technique I have learned to like, but it's an acquired taste. You learn to like it because you learn to accept the things you don't like about yourself as you're talking. And I haven't liked much of myself for much of my life. And for all the right reasons, I might add. And my wife has made me have understanding in that I don't have total what's the word I want? I now have an explanations for my behavior that I understand them. And if you understand them, you can redirect them. And she's helping
Does the vulnerability scare you?
Vulnerability is the most spooky thing there is, because when you're not, you know, defensive, you are hurtable. And so of course that is the hardest time. But I also trust her. I trust her with my life, with my emotional life. And so I can put my emotional life in her hands and know she will not take advantage of it. And that's why we're married 28 years later, I'm sure.
I know.
How she treats me and how I don't deserve it probably half the time. Half the time I do, but I'm sure half the time.
You know, we're going to wrap in a second, but obviously people are going to get mad at me if I don't acknowledge you have an amazingly talented daughter, Emma. And look at this picture of you guys, her as a little girl.
Yeah.
She was 9 years old in that shot.
And she is expecting now, right? She hasn't had
the baby. Baby.
And his name is Rhodes. Yes.
Oh, wait, we lost him.
He is with us.
He is. Well, we're back. We're back.
That's all the times are free.
I know. We're back. Go ahead. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you.
Okay. So what were you saying about him? So he is with us already.
The baby's been born already.
Okay.
And you're a
grandfather.
And I'm a grandfather for the second time.
Oh, I didn't know that.
My stepdaughter and her wife have a little girl who is now 21, 22 months
23
old.
23
months. 23 months old, named Georgia. And Georgia calls her Fama and me, Hey.
she has names for you.
Hey. Hey.
And so it really is a family business. You know, it's interesting when you think that was it your mom and dad that were both acting teachers?
My mother was an acting teacher up till her death, I think.
And, yeah, I think so.
Mom and dad opened an acting school called The Actors and the Writers Workshop in 1962. And in 1963, I was on my first TV series called Bum Bum and His Buddies.
Never heard of it.
For a year for WAI in Atlanta, Georgia. And then I was in repertory theater from 1964 to 1972. All year, every year, doing 8 to 12 plays a year. That's how I grew up. That's what I did.
That is, it's in your blood. And then, of course, I have to acknowledge you have a very famous sister, Julia. You have two sisters, but Julia, we all know.
I'm so proud of Julie because Julie has become one of my favorite actors over the years. She's an extraordinary actor, and I'm so proud of her.
You know, it's so interesting that you broke so much earlier. You really had your breakout very early.
It's six degrees of separation. When I met her on an airplane in 1989, she reminded me that I told her about my sisters, about both of them, and wanted to set up a meeting with her and my sisters.
Wow!
Because I had just cast a project that we shot with John Travolta and Benjamin Bratt, actually.
We ended up being a Julia Roberts' boyfriend.
Called Chains of Gold. We were shooting in Florida, and I was in Florida and New York. And so when Eric heard that I was a casting director, he was pitching. It was so cute.
But he wasn't pitching himself. He's pitching his sister.
No, he wasn't pitching himself.
Yeah, I was pitching my sisters.
Yeah.
See, again, that says a lot about him, doesn't it?
Yeah. Passing the torch is the best feeling.
Would you want your grandchildren to go into the business?
You know, it's up to them. It is the greatest business on the planet. So if I can recommend a business to them, I would recommend this. But it's up to what they want to do. And if they want to do it, I'm going to help them.
All right. And last thing, Eric, I have to ask you. I saw, was it last year, you were doing some product promotion for the Rocket. Eric, what is the Rocket?
A friend of mine comes to me and he goes, Eric, I wanted to advertise a product for me. It's the cure for erectile dysfunction. I said, well, you can count me out. See you later. And he goes, no, listen to what I've done. I said, I'll listen one time. If it sells me, great, but it's not going to go. And he goes, here's what causes erectile dysfunction. It is, what's it called?
Plaque.
We have plaque in our
plaque?
Blood.
Plaque
in our blood. And it goes through our system all day, every day. And it slowly clogs things up, like our heart system is clogged up with plaque. We have to get heart stents and heart surgery, all kinds of stuff, because of plaque. It's all caused by plaque. Okay, the penis has the same issue with blood flow. It gets plaque in the little veins, and so it doesn't get blood flow. And when they explain this to me, it's as simple as that, Eric, blood flow. And I have something that gives you back your blood flow. I said, I don't believe in chemicals. It's not a chemical. Ha!
I said,
okay, tell me about it. He goes, you know sound waves. Here's what they do in all the sex clinics, but it costs a fortune. And they have these big machines that do it. I have a machine that fits in the palm of your hand, and it does it. And it's affordable. And here's what it does. And you go over the shaft of your penis, and it goes, and it's very quiet, and you don't even feel it. It goes over your penis, and it cleans out the plaque, and you get blood flow again, and you have erections that are like you always wanted them. And when he told me all this, I don't have any issues, so I didn't know how to check it out. Mm-hmm. But guys who have bought this, who talk to me, say, Eric, I've never made a better investment. I'm like, cool. So he said, so will you talk about it? Because you're not a guy who's going to do something because somebody pays you money. Because you're not that guy. And everybody knows that. At least all the guys that I've talked to, they all say, if Eric Roberts says it's cool, I'm going to think it's cool. Because Eric Roberts wouldn't do that for money, especially over a tool about your junk. This is a serious issue, dude. I mean, if I didn't have a sex life, I'd be mad all the time.
Eliza would be too.
I would be too. I'd be like, what am I doing here? I got to get out of here.
What did you think, Eliza, when he told you about this?
Well, we're mutual friends with John. We loved.
He's the inventor.
Yeah, we loved. Yeah. Think about it. It fits with my stuff that we just talked about. We loved that it wasn't a drug.
Right. Sure. No, you're very healthy.
Shrouded as something that people should talk about, right?
Everybody's got plaque. Everybody will have an issue with their erection eventually somehow. It's going to happen. And
age, sex, all that stuff that's important to talk
plaque.
About.
Plaque. It's going to happen to everyone. This is what the guy explained to me, John Hoffman. He's a great inventor. He got to figure it out. This is what caused it, dude. We're going to get rid of it. You can have sex at 99 years old. He was so proud of it.
Oh, then you better hold on to the rocket. You may need it someday.
Look, I plan to use it, okay? Whenever I need it, I plan to use it. I have no issue.
You know, the idea that I'm ending this interview talking about penises with Eric Roberts... What more do I need in life? This is like one for the books. First off, I have to thank, before anyone else, I have to thank Eliza, because we've been talking for months. I have become her best friend. I want to marry Eliza now, Frank.
Buddy, it's a big line.
I went into this wanting to sleep with Eric, but now it's really all about Eliza. I kind of get it. That's it. Well, I know. And Eric, let me just tell you, I thought I knew you. I thought that I had done my research and I followed your career for years. But sitting with you, you are such a delight. You're so real. You're so honest. You're so vulnerable. You have just been a delight.
Aww. Thank you so much. That is so nice. You can thank my mother who raised me.
You were certainly raised right. And I'm going to thank your mother. I'm going to thank your sisters. And I'm going to thank your wife who's still raising you. She's got her hands full.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you both for being on the show. Eric and Eliza, you've been great. Thank you so much. I hope to talk to you again soon.
Yes, please. Sure. Please.
Okay.
All right.
Take care. And hopefully when this pandemic's done, we'll do something in person. You can show me your rocket then.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Bye-bye. Thank you. Oh, my God. Eric and Eliza Roberts. They are a delight. I never would have imagined how much fun they are. And I feel like I've known them forever. Thank you all for watching Billy Masters Live. Next week, we will be here Tuesday and Thursday. I cannot announce my guests. I may have Eric and Eliza back every week. But you can look for us online, billymasters.com/TV, on our YouTube channel, Billy Masters TV. And what can I tell you? Thanks. Take care of yourselves. Oh, good. I guess I'm going to say goodbye to Eric in a second when we're done with this, when I'm wrapping up. So stay there, guys. We'll talk afterwards. Thank you for watching. Take care of yourselves. And remember, if we're here, we're live. Bye, guys.